Ideas matter. Ideas matter. This is Dialogue.
Hello and welcome to Dialogue. In a world where the specter of a nuclear war looms large and geopolitical tensions continue to increase, the discourse surrounding nuclear weapons has become increasingly urgent. From calls for disarmament to debates over deterrence, the global community is grappling with complex questions over the roles of nuclear arsenals and if they ensure security or perpetuate risk. China has recently called for nuclear weapon states to finalize a policy of no first use of nuclear weapons. What are the core concepts of the policy? What's the significance of such a policy for a safer and more stable world against a backdrop of growing uncertainty and conflicts? Will the US, Russia, and other nuclear powers join China's efforts on the no first use policy? Joining me today are Zhou Bo, Senior Fellow at the Center for International Security and Strategy at Tsinghua University, Dr. Yan Oberg, Director of the Transnational Foundation for Peace and Future Research, and Dr. Alexander Titov, Lecturer in Modern European History at Queen's University, Belfast. Welcome to Dialogue. Zhou Bo, I will start with you. You know, since August, of course, there's a recent report in New York Times that China has repeatedly called for nuclear weapon states to finalize a no first use policy of nuclear weapons. Tell us, what's the thinking behind such a move, such a proposal?
It's really an eye-opener for me because this has been Chinese policy for decades. And for the first time, I saw in New York Times, this kind of proposal about no first use, although it was written in a very indirect way. But I was really happy, to read this because right now, given the war in Ukraine and given China's clear position that no nuclear weapons should be used. So I think right now we should really seriously think about no first use of nuclear weapons. Because I myself have actually written quite a few opinions suggesting that NATO actually can be the first to declare no first use first against Russia. Why? Because it's totally affordable. Does NATO want to use nuclear weapon first against Russia? Of course not. Yeah. So in this doing, it would actually, to some extent, discourage the potential, threat from Russia to use nuclear weapon. So I think that right now, to talk about no first use is really, really a good start, a good new start.
Dr. Yan Oberg, what do you make of the Chinese effort to push for the at least the five nuclear powers here, internationally acknowledged, to reach a policy, to reach an agreement, let's say no first use against each other to avoid, let's say, a worse scenario for the world?
I think it's a very responsible and concerned proposal. And I also am aware that this no first use has basically been China's policy since 1964. The problem is that there's somebody, including NATO and the US, who reserves the right to be the first to use nuclear weapons, also against conventional attacks. And also, I think, seen in a larger perspective, of course, the point of no first use is that if everybody kept to that, there would not be a nuclear war. But we cannot trust completely that in, given the situation of tension and panic or whatever, would be practiced. So therefore, I would see such a treaty, which I welcome, as a step towards what is the real thing to do, and that is the total abolition. Mm-hmm. And we have a treaty internationally from, I think, 3 years back with a majority of countries behind it, that nuclear weapons must go, must become a parenthesis in human civilization. And so if it can lead to everybody deciding to go down, either unilaterally or as part of negotiations, I think it's a great proposal. As you know, I've always been against nuclear weapons. I think they are destabilizing, they're militarily useless, they are unethical, and they built on the idea that terrorists built on, namely the conscious destruction, the unavoidable destruction and killing of civilians who are not party to a conflict. I don't think that anybody, government or individual, should be assuming the responsibility to decide the future of whether or not humanity should exist in the future. So I welcome that idea, but it's only a stepping stone towards something more serious.
Mm-hmm. Zhou Bo, I want you to continue to talk about, you know, China's no first use policy, which has been rather consistent, you know, as Yan pointed out, since 1964. Tell us more about the details. You know, does it mean first use, no first use against other nuclear powers? What about the non-nuclear powers, for example?
Well, yes, you're correct that after China detonated the first nuclear devices in 1964, China actually has made a number of pledges. One is no use of nuclear weapons against nuclear weapon-free countries and the nuclear weapons-free free zones. The second is not to be the first to use nuclear weapons. It's very interesting for us to observe that, because at that time, China was actually in a very much defensive opposition. And because of the impact of such a nuclear test, I think China just is more than willing at that time, yeah, to demonstrate its goodwill, or as a kind of a kind of appeasement toward other nuclear powers. But it turned out that this actually becomes the most beautiful things, yeah, among the nuclear weapon states, because China is the only country that actually has made such a pledge. I mean, India, of course, is a de facto nuclear weapon state that has made a similar pledge. But China is the earliest one, and China is officially the only nuclear weapon state that has made such a pledge. This is what I'm said before, because right now there is a war going on in Europe. I fully agree to Alexander when he said that Russia used this kind of a strategy, and I believe that Russia's threat, yeah, actually is a strategy of to escalate before de-escalate, has really played its due role. But then the point is, as I mentioned, if everybody's worried about such a nuclear war, if everybody agrees that a nuclear war cannot be fought because it could not be won, which is actually a Cold War slogan, then why just for example, China, U.S., France and Britain reach similar agreement first? Because China and Russia have already have this kind of no first use against each other because it's a good relationship. So right now, if China and all three nuclear powers made some kind of agreement on this, and then we come back to Russia to say, hey, anyway, you have said something similar, right? You have promised, you have promised and said that nuclear war cannot be fought because it could not be won. So I don't mean this is possible right now, but I believe this is a really, really concrete step forward in nuclear disarmament.
Mm-hmm. Alexander, in the U.S., there have been discussion in the past years over whether they adopt no first use policy or not. Tell us, why is it so difficult to adopt such a policy? As Zhou mentioned, we know nobody can afford to have a nuclear war. Why don't we just say, we follow such a policy, no first use against each other?
Well, I mean, traditionally, the NATO policy and United States, when you talk about nuclear policy, it's really United States nuclear policy, with so far as NATO is concerned. That was the idea that they would compensate for the deficiencies or in the conventional arms, that they were seen that the Soviet bloc had superiority in conventional forces, therefore, to stop them from using that superiority, the nuclear weapons had to be on the table. Now the situation has reversed in many ways, that NATO is conventionally stronger than Russia, and they still have parity in nuclear weapons, so that's why Russia is very important for it to retain that ambiguity. So far as the United States is concerned, I think there's a lot of things in terms of internal discussion. So President Biden was campaigning on that, I think, on introducing no first use policy. But once you start talking to the military, various environment scenarios, you have to understand that, of course, the United States is this global power which has relations not just in Europe, in NATO, but everywhere, essentially, right? So the Korean Peninsula is one very important one. Of course, North Korea has nuclear weapons now. You have, in a way, kind of Cold War with China, with various sanctions and so forth going on, trying to build an anti-Chinese coalition in many ways in the Pacific, offering considering somebody like Japan, kind of a nuclear umbrella, is an important policy incentive for the United States to use for others. So it's complicated for the United States because there are different factions, there are different ideologies. I mean, Republicans in particular wouldn't want to kind of denounce nuclear weapons first use. So there's a lot of ideological things, there's a practical considerations, as well as issues dealing with specific countries around the world, which the United States are closely involved in. It's very hard for them to, you know, have a one unambiguous policy like that.
But Alexander, how much do we know, you know, what's the official U.S. policy on the use of nuclear weapons, for example?
Well, you know, they are... The United States, you know, you reserve the right to kind of to respond, and it's not taken off the first use either. You know, so that it is. There is a NATO doctrine in particular where it's not even that it can use nuclear weapons, not just against. Even when it itself is not threatened, for example, right? So that's very unusual because even in the Russian case, the nuclear use can only be done if its sovereignty is threatened. Where the United States can actually extending its umbrella when the United States itself is not threatened. For example, if there is attack on one of the NATO countries in Europe, which is, you know, reasonably unusual. So in that sense, the United States has a very peculiar way of dealing with its nuclear forces, but it's very hard for them to kind of to really move to an ambiguous policy as China has for a variety of reasons.
Mm-hmm. And if you look at Russia, of course, you know, Russia has talked about the potential use of nuclear weapons to defend itself, you know, over the Ukraine situation. But officially, what's the policy of the Russians in terms of the, you know, or the conditions for the use of nuclear weapons?
Well, I think it's been stated recently by President Putin that the idea is that if you feel threatened on your existence and you can't do anything else, then they will use nuclear weapons. I guess that would apply to most other countries too. The problem is that as long as we have these weapons, the risks are high, and they are often related to the concept of deterrence. And, I mean, there's no way you can have common security or build peace or trust with the idea I have a nuclear pistol that I point at your head and then I say, shall we talk now to each other? I mean, the whole idea of offensive deterrence rather than defensive deterrence is, in my view, destabilizing conventionally as well as by nuclear weapons. Then you can say, if we really wanted to get rid of this, some people will believe in negotiations. I don't think that necessarily is the only way. Charles Osgood in the late 50s or early 60s proposed something he called GRIT, something with a reduction of tensions. And the idea was that each country can take a small first step that does not... risk its own security and thereby invite others to follow so that you get a disarmament race, so to speak. But you have to unilaterally take the first step. Another way would be simply to have referendums in the countries that have nuclear weapons. And I'm not aware that there's ever been a referendum within any nuclear state. And the opinion polls we have about this is that there's no place where the majority of the people want their country to have nuclear weapons. So if you practice democracy, nuclear weapons will have to go, because this is only an idea that governments have. Mm-hmm. The far majority of humanity does not want nuclear weapons. They want nuclear-free zones, and they're fighting with the global peace movement and all that to get rid of these, doomsday weapons. I mean, who are we to think that somebody should have the right to play God and decide the future of all of us in this? I mean, if you use them militarily, you can't use the territory you've used them on in an aggression situation because it will be a radioactive desert. If you use them defensively, who would like to make your own country a nuclear? I mean, the whole thing is something that strategists and some people who want these weapons have told us, but there's a totally different intellectual, moral framework for which reason they must go. And that's why I believe that the abolition treaty is one of the most important we have in for humanity to stick to at the moment and say, hey, this is what you're obliged to do. If you have nuclear weapons, you're doing something which is against international law.
Well, on one hand, you know, people are, you know, insisting abolition of all those weapons. On the other hand, you do have countries like some of the U.S. allies, like Japan, in which has been vehemently against no further use of nuclear weapons, you know, against the U.S. adopting such a policy. What's the consideration? Of course, Japan is living under the nuclear umbrella of the United States.
Well, you see, to answer your question, I wish to point out, actually, Americans' nuclear foreign nuclear policy is not that far away from China. Because, you know, President Obama actually got a Nobel Prize simply because he championed nuclear-free world. Yeah, he did not do too much. He just talked about a nuclear-free world. And he got a Nobel Prize, right? Yeah, he lost many wars just because of calling that. And at that time, President Joe Biden was vice president. So he was fully aware of this kind of argument. So actually, before the release of nuclear posture review, many people in the United States worry that Joe Biden would announce no first use. So you can see this kind of argument is not only a Chinese argument. Actually, it has become a very powerful voice in the United States. So that is why, and officially, Americans' policy on use of nuclear weapon is that they would only use nuclear weapons in extreme circumstances. So that is why it's already very close to China's policy. And when you talk about Japan, Japan is very much like South Korea. They're just American allies. Yes, they want nuclear umbrella, basically out of a kind of a psychological effect. Yeah, because you have to consider, as I have argued before, who really would launch a preemptive nuclear strike on them first, knowing that this kind of strike would definitely invite a devastating nuclear retaliation, right? Mm-hmm.
Basically, I mean, that's a situation impossible in a sense, Alexander, right? I mean, no country will launch a nuclear attack against U.S. allies, you know, because they are under the nuclear umbrella, or against another nuclear state. That's a suicidal, I mean, move there.
At the same time, I mean, as I think what the war in Ukraine illustrates now, that nuclear weapons are also a factor in decision making on other fields as well. So, decision to not to send NATO troops directly into Ukraine is fundamentally hinges on Russia's idea that statement that if its sovereignty is threatened directly, it might use nuclear weapons, and if this includes Crimea, which has been part of Russia officially from the Kremlin's point of view since 2014 and so forth. So it's Russia is not going to use it, but as I said earlier, you know, if it's about to fall and suffer major defeat, and there is kind of NATO Ukrainian troops marching onto Moscow, the nuclear weapons to make sure that this doesn't happen. I mean, it doesn't even cross anybody's mind to start NATO involvement, direct involvement. Nuclear weapons are actually very useful from Russia's point of view, and I mean, there is absolutely no way they will renounce it in these circumstances. So I'm afraid it's not just say it's so simple, let's just agree not to use it. There are conditions not to use it. So we're not going to use it unless you get directly attack us with conventional weapons, for example. And for the states, as I said, NATO was in this position during the Cold War. The roles has been reversed now. Russia in that position where it's less powerful conventionally, and at the same time has basically direct conflict. I mean, there are NATO advisors and operators inside Ukraine. There is kind of huge involvement, which might not be officially acknowledged in Ukraine in terms of intelligence, in terms of targeting, etc., etc. You know, the only thing which, well, not the only thing, but, you know, major thing which stopping it from, you know, escalating even further is nuclear weapons. So yeah, I'm afraid it's not going to be just a no first use and we forget about it. It's much, much more complicated.
Mm-hmm. Yim, if you look at today's world, of course, you know, you do see Ukraine wall there, Gaza, of course, currently Iran and Israel. What do you see as the greatest nuclear threat, you know, facing the international community? Is it between, say, nuclear powers? Is it, probably the possession of, nuclear weapons by terrorist organizations or the Ukraine situation, for example?
It is both of the things you mentioned. And I think we should also mention the accidents with nuclear weapons. Nuclear armored submarines colliding. Nuclear weapons have been dropped at Greenland and one of them not found. Drunk or otherwise non-clear officers in nuclear command centers. I mean, all these reports exist and they are not propaganda. So we're living every day at the with hope that things will not go madly wrong. I belong to those who think that there are no nuclear weapons that are not for use. Because if deterrence fails, the weapons we have will be used. Otherwise, if everybody knew that they would not be used, there would be no deterrence effect in them. That means when people say nuclear weapons are there never to be used, they have not understood what deterrence, offensive deterrence with these weapons imply, namely that if it fails, they will be used. So therefore, the only long-term security for humanity is abolition. And I kind of want to repeat, perhaps, that the thinking is something that leads to the weapons. And when the weapons are there, they influence our thinking. But I am of the opinion, if you ask for risk, and I'm now saying something that may be provocative to some people, I followed political decision-making and attitudes to nuclear weapons in Europe the last more than 40 years. And I am quite convinced that it's possible to say that politicians who operated these systems 30, 40 years ago were much more prudent, much more knowledgeable, much more careful with nuclear weapons than those we have today. I do not see intellectuals in the Western world knowing what they are talking about, whether it comes to Ukraine or it comes to Middle East or whatever. It's weapons, 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 no diplomacy anymore. And, you know, at some point, my feeling is, or what I think as a peace researcher that I shall try to warn about, is this idea that everybody's controlled. They know what they do. Don't worry about it. We have people who make panic decisions in Europe, such as the sanctions response to Ukraine. We have people who have destroyed their own economy. We have people who destroyed Nord Stream. All these are things that are not intellectually thought through and have been made without any impact assessment of the long-term consequences. Now, if we build up tension, there's a risk that some fool who doesn't know and never read books and have bad advisors will use these weapons because he or she thinks that, oh, then I'm a great statesman. Mm-hmm. Conclusion, I am today more afraid of the people who make decisions than I am of the weapons themselves.
Joe Bo, of course, you know, I think people all remember this, the MAD theory, you know, mutually destructive for the nuclear powers, you know, in particular, or mutually assured destruction, or MAD theory, you know, during this the time of Cold War, does it still hold water today? You know, for the nuclear powers against each other.
Well, that's a very good question. Yeah, because that kind of a most horrible equilibrium was actually reached between the two superpowers with almost. Two equally large nuclear arsenal, right? So actually your question would invite a question whether, you know, all nuclear powers could actually talk about nuclear disarmament in a multilateral way. The answer is no, because so far China has refused to join any kind of multilateral or even bilateral, you know, talks. Basically, China believes that its own nuclear arsenal is too small compared with that of Soviet of Russia and that of United States. Yeah, because for that to happen, either China would drastically increase its nuclear numbers, or for the United States or Russia to drastically reduce its nuclear warheads. Neither is possible. So I don't believe any such kind of nuclear talks is a reality. It won't. So right now, I don't believe we would see this kind of a mutually assured destruction, which can only happen between the United States and Russia. But the background has totally changed, right? So during the Cold War, it's almost a sure thing. Well, people think it might really happen, mm-hmm. but nowadays nobody would think that we would have this kind of mutually assured destruction anymore. So in other words, we're living in a safer world, although this kind of risk is still there.
Alexander, final words, move forward. What should be done against such a rising tension, people feel uncomfortable with this, all the conflicts ongoing around the world. And of course, the possession of nuclear weapons. It seems there's something we need to be done to reduce, to give people assurance, probably a sense of safety.
Well, I have to agree with Professor Hu that one of the problems during the Cold War, people were scared of it and took it much more seriously, particularly after the Caribbean Missile Crisis. And you have, Dr. Strangelove, wonderful film, anybody wants to see it, just to remind themselves of the dangers of a nuclear war, and decision-making which leads to it, right? Sometimes accidental one. But I think now it's really, we are in this uncontrollable spiral because... whatever you say about the Cold War, but it was stable in Europe. I know there was a Berlin crisis, but broadly speaking, though the lines were drawn and nobody really, were interested in crossing them militarily. Now the lines are completely blurred. You have ongoing full-scale war, which NATO is all but participant in. And in the last year, since the failed counteroffensive in Ukraine, it's not going well for it. And there'll be a decision-making for NATO.
Well, on that note, we have come to the end of today's show. Many thanks to our guests. You can also find us on the CGTN app on YouTube. I'm Chin Duo.
Ideas matter. Ideas matter. This is Dialogue.